Accession number 9168, rule number 8.
Mr. Amat, reel 8. Were you allowed to let people back home know what had happened to you?
Yes. When I was first taken prisoner on the day after I was taken prisoner at this place at Douai in the brickworks, we were interrogated by an officer and some other German NCOs and asked to give us our name, rank and number, and we were always told not to give anything other information, where we were and all the rest of it. But after we'd been interrogated there, we came away, and as we went out, one of the German officers handed us a card, a buff card, and on it was printed Gurkentaken Lager, which is a German prisoner of war camp, you see. And underneath you had to put your number, rank, name, and then there was a printed phrase, "I am well," and you sort of either said yes to this questionnaire, and there was other questionnaires, and two or three lines at the bottom in which you can put a message and sign it, and put the date up the top. These were collected, and we were told that they were going through the Red Cross channels via Switzerland back to England. But in my particular case, and in a lot of others, afterwards I found out that this didn't happen at all. Anyway, another incident I'd like to recall while I was at this large factory near the canal was later on, as we got towards end of September, beginning of October, we were all marched out one day, well, nearly all the camp, several hundred of us, I suppose, with guards on either side, which we used to do every morning. And as we walked along these streets of these villages, we used to break ranks now and again if we saw something like a cigarette end or a crust of bread on the side of the road, and we'd go off and pick it up and put it in our pocket, because it's not realised until you know, until you've been through these things, what you do under such stress. I remember I had a tin I used to keep in my pocket, and of course I used to smoke in those days, nearly everybody did in the trenches, and I picked up these cigar ends nearly always, and of course the Germans used to smoke a lot of cigars and so did the French. I used to take these back in this tin, and when I got back I'd cut them up with an old razor blade and use part of perhaps a Bible or some paper that was available to make cigarettes with, to smoke. And this was, well, nearly everybody did the same, actually. And then any type of food that we could find. I remember we used to, if we saw a field of potatoes or turnips or beetroot or anything like that, we'd all break ranks and dig them up with our bare hands, pull them up and put them in our pockets or carry them along with us. Then most men used to get hold of a sandbag and used to always keep this with them, and that was used to carry any thing they could pick up en route when we used march back with the forwards to our work. And anyway, about October, beginning of October, we all marched out this day, 2 or 3 miles, and we to a slope, and dispersed in lines, and there was heaps of shovels and picks there, and we were told, we had an interpreter with us, by the way, and he was a chap from one of the Yorkshire regiments, and he could speak German, and he used to interpret all the orders and all that sort of thing to the to us through the from the Germans. And we were told to pick up these picks and shovels, and go along a bit farther, and there the ground was all marked out with white paper into what everybody knew was a form of trenches, mm-hmm. with all the bays and the communication trenches and all that, all set out in this white paper tape. And we were told to start digging trenches there. Well, there was a lot of murmurs and amongst the chaps there, especially there was a strong Scottish element with us, and they all said that we shouldn't be doing this because of the Geneva Convention. We're not supposed to prepare defences for an enemy against their own troops. And anyway, after a bit, the word come down right through the whole of all our chaps that we was to down tools and refuse to do it, which we did. And we stood there looking at the Germans, and the under-officer who was in charge of the operation came over and started shouting and gesticulating to us. That's, and the interpreter told us that the under-officer said he's going to take drastic action now unless we started digging. And we all said, no, we're not. And he told the under-officer, and then the interpreter said, if you don't start within a certain time, or it was 5 minutes or something like that, he was going to line us all up and shoot one in every 10. And anyway, we still hung out, and the under-officer got all the guards. There was about 30 guards, because there was quite a number of prisoners there. He lined them all up facing us, and he took one or two NCOs with him, and he came along. We were all lined up in a line. He came along and started counting iron swire dry along the line until we got to 10, you see. And then that 10th man was the one that was going to be picked out to be shot. And I know there's much shoveling and changing when people realised that they might be number 10 or 20 or whatever it was. So, but after a time, there was a scuffle at the corner of the field, and some mounted people came through a gateway, rode up to where these soldiers were lined up, and we could see when he came closer that it was a tall German officer who had a black patch over his eye, and he carried a riding crop in one hand, and there were several other German officers mounted with him. And he called over to this under-officer, and he... we don't know what was said, but we could more or less tell it. And he raised his arm and shouted at this under-officer. And the under-officer said something about what he'd been doing, you see, and he shouted and raved again, this officer, and waved his... riding crop, and our interpreter was quite near the scene, intended to take any orders to us, and he eventually came over and he said that he was a general, this chap on the horse, had said that we were all forgiven for what we'd done, and we were all to be marched back to camp and given an extra ration of bread, because he said he admired our spirit. We were there at this building and in this camp for a few days after that, and then, oh, by the way, while I was there, we heard the British guns, or guns of some sort, in the distance, and every day they seemed to get nearer. The sound of the shell fire and the guns seemed to get nearer, and we began to realise that there must be a big attack looming. And
what was your treatment generally by the Germans?
Oh, fairly, I suppose, up to the point that they hadn't got anything themselves, and their rations were very meagre, and I don't remember seeing any newspapers or any communication of anything as to what was going on in the rest of the world, and nothing like that at all. But on the whole, they were pretty fair chaps, because, as I say, most of them were, pardon, all Saxons, and or Bavarians, not the Prussians, who were, of course, different type of people altogether. And I suppose they were, same as us, fed up with the whole war. Anyway, we one day we were told to pack up, and we tied our possessions, what there were, a couple of paper-type blankets and our sandbags and our tins and bits and pieces with us, and we started marching back. We had there was no form of transport as such, no horse transport, no motor transport, but all the rest of the stuff, including the boilers where the cooks performed, and all that thing was all putting on four-wheeled army carts and pulled along by our chaps. There was one or two in the shafts, and then there was ropes fixed to either side with loops on them, and half a dozen people on either rope pulling, and we pulled all. That's how we went back. We only used to do about 8 or 9 miles a day, sometimes less than that, because we're all very weak, and and we had to, when we got to a place, we had to more or less sleep out in the open, and it was October, and we had no form of shelter at all, hardly. It's, every time we went back, whatever few miles, we could still hear the guns in the distance, and we knew that the British or the Allies must have been advancing, although we had no news at the time, you see. Anyway, we got back to... we went right through the... remember, at the time, went right through the where the Battle of Waterloo was fought. At, forget the name of the place. There was a big battle there the day before Waterloo, and at this village, and we saw, as we went by, the there was a mound which had been erected by the Belgium, I think it was, because we were in Belgium at that time, to commemorate the Battle of Waterloo, and on the top was a cross, and that was the site of the Battle of Waterloo. We passed by there, I know, and then what we used to do was march so many miles, then stop, and then usually stop in a village, and one of the church there, nearly every village had one or more churches, were all cleared of, the Germans had taken all the pews, the wooden parts away, and it was just an empty church. So we used to stop there, and they'd bundle us all into the church, lock the doors, and we'd spend the night there on the floor. Well, the villagers in these places where we stopped heard that we were coming, and they used to gather straw and hay and line all the floors with it, so that we had a certain amount of warmth and comfort while we stopped there. Remember one place we got to, and there was low windows on this church hall place, and in the night I heard a bit of noise, and I saw a couple of chaps coming through the window from outside and talking, and they said they'd been out, got through the sentries who were not supposed to be marching round the church, guarding us, and gone out into the village, and had had a meal one of the Belgium houses, and they from their description I more or less guessed where it was and what it was. So I said to one of the chaps that who was in one of the London bridges for me, I said, let's go and see what we can do. So we got out of the window after we'd seen the sentry pass by, got over a low wall, went up the village street, found what we thought was this house, and it was getting on for dawn then. And anyway, this chap who I was with, he was a Lance Corporal, by the way, and I was only a rifleman, but he was a bit scared, and he said we heard Germans coming along, German soldiers, because they used to wear those jack boots and you could hear them a mile off, really. So we scuttled behind a hedge, and he was all for going out and putting his hands up and giving himself up, and I gave him a few words of advice about this, and I said, no, I'm not going to do anything like it, you keep there and all. And kept him down until these soldiers went by, and then we came out, and we found a gateway with one door ajar, which one of those big gateways at the side of these houses where, you know, a carriage could get through. So we went in and knocked on the back door, and a woman opened the door, and well, before we could say anything, she pulled us inside and then spoke to us, and apparently she could speak English, but she was a Belgian, and she said, we asked her if she'd, you know, for something to eat, and she said, yes, all right, but first of all, stop there, take all your clothes off, and I'll give you some fresh clothes. And there was a servant woman there, and she told her in Belgium or French, whatever it was they spoke, to get some hot water. And they got one of these old-fashioned tin bars that they used to use, mothers used to use in this country for doing the weekly washing. And this woman poured some hot water and into this bath, and the woman gave us some soap and a towel, and we each took it in turn and had a bath. And the woman who was in charge of the house, she bought us some clothes. And I remember there was old clothes that was left off by what I found out of was a doctor. She was the doctor's wife. And I had an old pair, he was a big fella, and these clothes were fitting me like sacks. And an old pair of dress trousers that he'd discarded, and one of his old starched white front shirts, and one or two other bits of clothing, and the other chap was similarly clothed. And after we'd got dressed, she took us upstairs into a bedroom and told to keep quiet. And when we got there was two other chaps there, two other British soldiers there that we didn't recognise at first, but they spoke and we knew who they were. They were British soldiers. They were dressed in all sorts of odd bits of clothing. And in this room there was one double bed. And anyway, after a bit, the woman came up and brought us all a bowl of soup and some bread. But she told us that we must keep away from the window, and we were to keep quiet, not make any noise at all, especially during the day, which we did. Anyway, we stayed we stayed there up in that bedroom every day, and we used to take it in turns to sleep in the double bed. Two used to sleep one night, and two on the floor, and two and reversed the procedure the following night. And anyway, we were glad to lose all our lousy clothing, and we were more or less free from any lice then, although several of the men found somewhat in their hair. But after she, the woman had given us a couple of combs, and we had a wash with some real soap, we managed to overcome that. The relations of this doctor came from time to time to visit us, and they brought cigarettes and all sorts of things, and we exchanged addresses and tried to chat up one another in broken French and English, and it was all quite enjoyable and quite a change after what we'd been through. Then in the evening, since it got dark, we were taken downstairs and went out into what was a part of their garden, a big orchard, and that's where we had our exercise, because being a doctor, I suppose he realised that human beings can't be coped up into one room like that all day long and all night. And we used to spend an hour each, take it in turns, two of us for 1 hour and then the other two and then so on till we got our exercise, and then we'd go back and we got three fairly good meals a day, and we were able to have a smoke now and again. Of course, that was all very nice after what we've been through. And one day, I was there about, 3 or 4 weeks, I suppose, like this, in this daily routine. And then one day, there's great excitement, and the woman below said that the British, the Allies had, the Germans rather, had asked for an armistice, and they met, and this doctor read out some of the details of what was going to happen. The Germans had surrendered, and we were, and all the things that had to be given up to the Allies, and what would happen to all the prisoners and all that sort of thing. Anyway, the Belgians said they would still be very careful, because although an armistice had been signed, the Germans were in no way inclined to relent their dominance over the population. So we had to still carry on stopping where we were and taking the precautions we did. But one morning, as we were upstairs in this bedroom, we looked out the window and we saw a couple of British cyclists come by. There was what used to be used as reconnaissance troops. They were on cycles or on horseback, and these two chaps came along, and then another bunch of about 20 or 30, all on cycles. And so we rushed downstairs, and next we saw was a troop of Canadian Dragoons. And we rushed out to them, and being as we were dressed like we were, I suppose they recognised us as British soldiers, but anyway, they after we'd spoken, and they realised we were English and were in fact British soldiers, the prisoners of war, they gave us cigarettes, and we were told to report to an officer after we'd said our goodbyes to the people in the house. And he was a major, and he asked us if we knew of any place where Germans might be hiding who should have gone back with the other troops. And but we told him that we didn't know of anybody who was harbouring German soldiers. So eventually we were taken to a table under a tree with a chap was sitting in the chair, and all our details was taken down. Then we were told to wait there, and eventually a few more ex-prisoners were collected, and we were put on a lorry and taken back through all the short pot roads with a bumpy ride right through the night almost, until we arrived at a little village it was, And here there was all sorts of people, Belgium, women and children, and refugees, and all sorts of mixture of all sorts of people, soldiers and everybody. And there they, the British had set up a kind of area, of a clearance area, where people were transferred from one part to another, civilians segregated from the soldiers, and food was available in ample supply. And anyway, we stopped there only one more night, and then we were put on another lorry, and this took us farther back through our own lines to another village, and this was another clearing station. Here was another big building, and here we were put through a de-lousing system, given brand new underclothes and shirts and uniform and the usual kit that a soldier carries with him, his shaving kit and knife, fork, spoon and vesting and all that, and a couple of blankets to sleep in. We stopped there for several days, and then eventually we got back, or we they put us on a train, and I remember the train was, in those days, the trains were all, the windows were all blacked out, with the exception of little slits cut in just the top of the glass, where you could look out to see whether you were arriving at the right station or something. But they've done that because to stop the lights from the train being noticed by any enemy. There were these trains, somebody come along, cleared a lot of this, scraped a lot of this glass off, and we could see more or less like a normal train. And then we passed through all the old battlefields, right, passed through a place called Harsbrook, and Harsbrook was one of the places that had a battery in the first war, years of the war. And it was an area where they had, they were horticulturists, and there was these hundreds of large greenhouses with all the glass shattered, as far as your eye could see. Remember that part of it. And eventually we arrived up at a camp outside Calais.